Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations. My name is Richard McGregor, a Senior Fellow for East Asia at the Lowy Institute. My guest today is Desmond Shulme, the author of a new book, Red Roulette, an insider's account of wealth, power, corruption, and vengeance in today's China. I can tell you, by the way, that is a very accurate title for the book. Now, the book is really Desmond's life story and his marriage and then divorce, but it's also a startling fly-on-the-wall account of doing business in China during the country's Gilded Age, that is, the first decade of the 21st century. That was a time when China was growing at 10% a year and had just joined the World Trade Organization and was really taking off. Now, not surprisingly for someone who's written such a book, Desmond now lives in exile in the UK with his son. Now, Desmond, there's so much to talk about in this book and so much drama and so many interesting characters. Let's start with your former wife and business partner, Whitney Duan. Now, neither of you, as you describe, were red nobility. You didn't have the bloodlines of the party or the top-level party connections. Yet Whitney had this extraordinary skill in making those connections, and I really liked actually how you described this was a genuine skill to do this and to, you know, move in the top levels of the Communist Party in China. So can you describe, your relationship with her and the sorts of skills she did have to do that?
Well, we met beginning of the 2000. I was just joined the entrepreneur rank with a tech company, and then she was which is a software company, and she was running a hardware company. So we were at the one stage talking about merging the two company, trying to make a complete offer, and the merge eventually didn't happen. The merge between us happened. So, and then we were married for about, we married about 10 years, and then we divorced about 5-6 years ago.
Once you were business partners, before you were married, you were able to witness how she was able to make connections and do business.
Yeah, I mean, at one time, you know, I really, in my mind and belief, and I told some of my close friends, I said, she can't be the best networker that is in Beijing. And that's just, I know, you know, it's a very, very boastful statement, knowing that, you know, networking is all it is about in the Chinese business and political community, and Beijing is the heartbeat of China in that sense. So I think she really honed her skill because she joined the system, right, in China, Xitong, right, very early on, right from the beginning when she just stepped out of university. She was a star student graduate, and then she was start working as a secretary to the president of the university, which actually is the Army University. And then I think she got to observe close how senior people in the system actually work, how to interrelate, how do they interact. And then from that, she actually went to as a junior bureaucrat sent to a county in Shandong for a few years, and then I think she get to see how at the most fundamental level, or maybe the most sort of base of the system, how do they work, how do they, you know, at the county level, how do they, the officials and the bureaucrats, interact and actually get things done. And then from there, she start working for at that time, you know, in the 90s, the army are in all sort of business. So she start working for the real estate developer company owned by the army. So I think those experiences very early on in her career gave her the opportunity and to both observe closely and also hone her skill of how to interrelate and interact with people in the system.
Yeah, so she gathered knowledge of the system, she gathered knowledge of people, she gathered a sense of how human and emotional a lot of these connections were, but she also gathered, according to your book, that it was important to put on airs, as it were. So once you were playing at that level, you had to sort of display wealth and confidence. Is that right?
That's probably universally true in many different countries and many different circumstances. You put on an air of success to be successful, right, so to speak. So that I think is not particularly peculiar to China. I think what I just described earlier, I think it's very sort of China-specific or maybe China-centric.
The most remarkable connection that she made, well, both of you made, was the wife of Wen Jiabao, who eventually became China's premier, the number two, effectively, in the party state. You refer to the wife mainly as Auntie Jiang, Jiang Beili. I mean, that is remarkable to me. Tell us how you forged the connection with her and what that meant for your business.
I think what happened was, you socialize in the Beijing scenery, and then Auntie Jiang actually was she's a very active person. You know, she liked to meet people of all different sorts, and she want to just interact, because she started her career very early on with this jewelry retail company. It's one of the first jewelry company listed in Shanghai Stock Exchange. So she has been in the business world for a long time, has some experience with it, and then, you know, she's just that kind of bubbly personality. And then on an occasion, Whitney met with her having a dinner, and then from there, you know, they start a dialogue and eventually start a bonding. And in terms of business, obviously, you know, I put it in a book also. It's, you know, we call them, you know, we sort of refer like her as the Air Force. You know, the Air Force, you know, overshadowing the sky. They can drop a few bombs here and there. But we are the army on the ground. We are the ones who are actually doing the execution, making things happen, actually, you know, taking real estates, well, both figuratively and in real world.
I think the word you used was infantry for how it worked. And that was a great analogy, right. I thought, actually. She provided air cover, and then you sort of penetrated the target area. So it was really amazing. One of the most interesting things for me, of course, is Wen Jiabao, the premier, had a reputation as an austere man, a man of the people, incorruptible. But his wife was heavily involved in business. I mean, that was quite a contrast, was it not?
Yes, I mean, to the outside world, but, you know, but really it is human being. I mean, two things. I mean, I also try to make it clear in the book. One is, I think Auntie Jiang, doing all this, not really because this hunger for wealth, so to speak. It's really, you know, she has been in business well her very early on in her life. She's hunger for action. You know, she like to be in action. And then obviously, if action brings result in a business world, means wealth. I think that's really what drives her, is her hunger for action. In terms of Wen Jiabao, I mean, you know, that's a lot of rumors on the internet around in the Chinese community say, oh, he's a great actor, right? I mean, here a lot of people say he's a Oscar award winning actor, because, you know, the family is have such business empire, and then he has this image of as you just described it. But in my interaction with their family, I truly believe that he wasn't aware of it. I mean, he's aware of the lady is in business, because she has always been in business, but he's not aware how big an empire they have built.
Yes, I think that's interesting. I mean, if you look at, for example, Jiang Zemin, who's described in your book, you'd probably think he was a little bit aware of it. If you look at other leaders of other countries, like President Suharto in Indonesia, who was proud of his children's business dealings. But you really do think that Wen didn't have a sense of his wife's business dealings?
Because in our introduction, I mean, her, a lot of times, actually, you will see the leader's office, other political leaders, official office are actually getting involved in the business deals and making direct calls. And then they actually the person will actually sit in the dinners in their relatives' business dinners. And that was never the case. I mean, his office never made a call and on behalf, and he never showed up in anything. And then from our interaction with her, we know she cannot call on his support. But obviously, being the lady of the house, she has her own aura. but she has never called on her support, called on his support. So, and then she sort of really always shied away from that.
Part of the networking that we talked about earlier, that was to come back to that briefly, the putting on airs part. When I lived in China, we used to try and track the number plates of cars at different times and what they would tell us about people and the status that they illustrated. And you had a terrific story in there about the number plate that Whitney used all her connections to get hold of, because it would signify that she was a person of stature and standing. And it was a Beijing plate, A8027. Could you explain, you know, any Chinese person seeing that plate, what would those numbers tell them?
In China, it's actually a very defined class system. And then in terms of the number plates, different people have different, you know, different class have different plates, and it's very defined and it's strictly administrated. In her situation, that number is, first of all, it's 88, eight as, you know, eight and eight as number. It actually means it's a car plate belongs to the state council, and it's 0276, I think, 0027. It's a very, like, the smallest number, the more senior in the system. So it's a state council number. It's a very small number, and it means like this person is highly ranked within the system. And what happened is, it's this car will, you know, it's actually never been stopped and will not be stopped by traffic cops. And then, you know, you can go on bus lanes, you can, and we're giving the traffic, you know, the terrible traffic jams in Beijing all the time. That's actually very, very efficient.
That's right. And I can remember always that in the party secretary's number plate in Shanghai's 001, and the mayor's number plate was 002, which always gave you the proper hierarchy between the party and the government.
Yes.
You also used to entertain, I think, at the Beijing Hotel right next to Tiananmen Square. And that was very interesting as well, because it wasn't a matter of just having dinner, was it? It was a matter of the hotel courtesans or guardians, if you like, making sure that anybody coming in there didn't run into other parties so that they couldn't see your connections. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of this kind of anecdote in the book, which is, you know, from people from the outside of China, it seems like ridiculous, right? It's like scenery from another planet. It's like, really? You know, in Beijing Hotel, that's at the top level, that's a floor of private rooms. And in Beijing in general, people of relevance, so to speak, always die in private room because they don't want to be seen who is having relationship with whom. And in Beijing Hotel, being the sort of the highest ranking, the most important state-owned hotel, so you always the officials, senior official, minister and above are dining over there. So they actually have a control room of people, you know, getting people in and out of the hotel. And although they all need to take an elevator to the top floor and then walk through multiple rooms before they get into their room, that is actually a control room, people actually directing the traffic, making sure people coming into that floor and going to those rooms never meet another person of a substance on their way there.
Yes, the choreography of that was fascinating. One of the other things I found interesting was your portrayal of the lower level officials in Shunyi near Beijing Airport and running Beijing Airport itself. You called them the dirt emperors. And that was, I think, is revealing for outsiders as well, because they are extremely powerful in their own right. And I guess you wanted to convey that.
Yeah, I think every, you know, in the system China, China is, every official and bureaucrat try as hard as they can and as much as they can to make their fiefdom their own fiefdom, no outside influence, no other people. And then they're very, very protective of that because that's their sort of their king, their little kingdom of theirs. And then they can draw all kind of benefit if they can keep it that way.
And I guess they not only draw personal benefit, but they also build their area, correct, as well?
Yeah, of course. It's not just for personal benefit, because their career is also judged by how well do they run their fiefdom. And for the longest time, China is all GDP driven. So local officials want to, you know, drive up the GDP growth number as much as possible. And then, of course, if you can absolute say in your county, then you can do what you please to, you know, and then what you believe is right. Otherwise, and then that ultimately decides your fate of your career.
That's right. You can be very effective, in fact. But I think at the county level and at the top level, the situation you described is the rules, they're always fuzzy, constantly changing, often backdated. Now, China, of course, is a bureaucratic system. It's not really a rule of law system. So describe that for the outsiders. What are officials able to do? Have they got so much more room to move if the rules are, as you say, quite fuzzy?
I think I through my own business, I describe in the book, I gave a lot of example of that. Essentially, they can, within a certain limit, which is actually mostly the limit imposed by their superior, they can define the rule any way they wanted to. Let's just give example of the head of the county, the party secretary of the county. The party secretary of the county can devise economic policy. They control the police. They control the court in that county, and they control, you know, essentially they are the emperor of that particular county, and then they can run it any way they wanted to. And that's the way in a 2000s, that's how China works.
But is it similar at the top, or are the trade-offs much greater at the top?
Pretty much the same. You know, just a great example is you see what Xi Jinping is doing. You know, he basically rewrite the rules and in a shocking way to most of the world, it's like you can change the constitution at will, and then all of a sudden, that's the to be the party chairman can be a lifelong job.
Yes, we're about to see that unfold next year. But before we get to Xi, well, one of the things that's happening in recent times, particularly, there's been a big sort of crackdown on private entrepreneurs, tech companies in particular. But I thought it was interesting in your book that you really dated back the way the party started to turn against the private sector or the moneyed classes. I don't know whether it's the same thing. You sort of had it starting as early as 2005. Did I read that right? In other words, you felt the atmosphere changing even then?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of reflection, you know, in the process of writing this book, and also, you know, in a lot of soul searching in the last several years, looking back, my own experience and the history of China. I really think it's what's happening now, it's a systematic issue. It's not a Xi Jinping issue. A lot of the world's, you know, cast it as a Xi Jinping issue. It's like, if we change Xi Jinping, China would not be this way. In my own experience and what I sort of reflect on over the years, I think it's a system issue. I think if you look at Deng Xiaoping, you know, this quote-unquote reform and opening, it wasn't a reform and opening for the sake of reform and opening. It's because the state is bankrupt. They have no other choice but let the peasants and the farmers to grow their own crops, and then let the private and, you know, entrepreneurs to start business, and because the state was bankrupt. It was a sort of necessary evil in their eyes, so to speak. So the state is always has this tendency, the system always have this tendency encroach forward once it has the means to do it. I think the 08 is the financial crisis. It's an awakening moment for the Chinese. I think definitely in the leadership positions, people, and also for the society at large, it's just like, well, look at the world, it's crash and burning. And then we are doing well, and Asia is able to stand its ground because we hold our currency exchange rate steady. And then it comes to question, you know, maybe our system is not that bad. And then related to that question is actually they use the state-owned enterprise to intervene in the economy heavily. And that's two things related to that. One is they say, well, okay, if I don't have this all this state-owned enterprise and I can just like snap a finger, next day they're going to, you know, invest in starting a project. If I need to go through the private entrepreneurs and the private companies, you know, I need to use very different kind of indirect leverage. I cannot give direct commands. And they don't, they think that's not very efficient. Also, and then also doesn't, they don't think that works very well. And also at the same time, the West actually heavily intervened, the state heavily intervened, the Federal Reserve and all that. So they all, that also justify the sort of state intervention. So those two together, the system actually, the leadership actually have a very different view of the importance of state-owned enterprise, the importance of state-owned enterprise controlling the economy, and then giving the bureaucracy of the system, they always, you know, the bureaucrats at every level always want to have more control because it benefit them personally, benefit their system, their ministry, you know, they benefit everybody in sort of in their surrounding. So that's always this tendency to encroach forward and push by the private economy. So once the state has the means, and also in this kind of case, in this particular case, it also has a justification, then it's all going a different direction afterward. Xi Jinping is just quickened the pace even further. I truly do believe he fundamentally changed the case. He just quickened the pace.
I agree with that. I agree that the 2008 was a turning point, and I also agree that if Xi Jinping went tomorrow, there might be instability, but China wouldn't change because the, you know, he's really doing what the party has always wanted to do, but he can simply do it. He's a risk taker. But the other turning point, I guess, in Xi Jinping, and you record this in your book, and I've never seen this before, you have an account of the Politburo Standing Committee meeting, that's the elite leadership, deciding to proceed with corruption cases against Bo Xilai and, by implication, later Zhou Yongkang. Tell me, were you told about that firsthand by Auntie Jiang?
Yes.
So that is a very, and in telling you that, you know, it was quite a big deal for her to impart that information and for you to receive it, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, that kind of, I mean, I have several incidents in the book, you know, related to, you know, in this case, you're talking about Bo Xilai, and then another case, I talk about Ling Jihua and the Sun Zhengcai. I mean, you know, you pick it up immediately because those three incidents are important. I mean, that changed the power structure at the top level, and that changed the course of the history. In China, in a larger way, the world, and so that's one thing I think I would like to sort of emphasize. And the second thing I really want to be clear, you know, people keep talking about anti-corruption drive. You know, situation, and then including the situation with Whitney, it's nothing to do with corruption. It's all about power. It's all about political power. Sun Zhengcai, you know, Bo Xilai, they didn't go to prison, and you know, because of corruption, they went to prison because they are political rival of Xi Jinping, or at least Xi Jinping see them as a political rivals. And that's why they were sent to prison.
I have to ask you about corruption. I don't know whether this has been written about in China at all, but you will have your critics. You understand that. They will say you're talking about corruption, but you yourself were a beneficiary of that system. How do you answer that?
First of all, I want to say, you know, I I'm critical of myself in many different parts in the book, you know, not just the business part. I mean, I do a lot of reflection. I mean, I saw the book as a book for my son. It wasn't meant to be published because I don't want to publish, being knowing the personal cost you're probably aware of. And you know, I laid it all bare on the book, and then I will let a reader be the judge, you know, and am I really corrupt? And then is really profit and wealth is my driving force as a person. I mean, let them read the book. I mean, I have it all out in there. But I have to say, I mean, I make it clear one thing, and then is I never, I would say, pass the legal limit of, you know, of corruption. It's just simple facts. I mean, people we deal with, they can have means in China take cash from many, many different channels and sources. We provide access, a channel nobody else can provide. So even if I want to pass them cash, they would never take cash or profit from me, because I just, that's not a wise move. They want me to owe them the favor. So in the future, they may want to say, well, can the, you know, can the premier look, office look favorable on me? Can I get some information from you? Can I pass some information through you? So, you know, inference peddling, yes. But, you know, that's the third point I want to make is, hey, at the time, China was in a very different situation. I think we all look at China very, very differently. We all think, okay, first of all, this is how the system works, and I want to thrive and succeed in this system. And secondly, the success of the system at that time is seen like a betterment of China, a betterment of the world. It's a very different lie in different circumstances.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, if you read your book, you know, from the outside and objectively, frankly, China is a very successful country compared with many other developing countries. They've managed to grow much faster. But if you look at your book and you look at the entrails of the system, you often wonder, how on earth do they do that? So I want to ask you, do you think the system is sustainable? I'm not saying the country will collapse or the Communist Party will collapse, but can it continue to innovate, turn out economic growth, and really, I guess, challenge the US and the West? Can they keep it up if this is how it works?
Well, personally, I have serious doubts about that. And then, as you can read from my book, I mean, most senior people within the China system, even in the leadership position, has real doubts about it. That's why they call it a musical chair. So each leadership is like, you know, a man in a leaking bowl with huge issues, but then unable to fix those issues, and they pass on the baton to the next guy. And hopefully they, you know, the whole thing doesn't blow up on their watch.
Well, we're seeing a bit of that right now, actually, with the unraveling of the big Evergrande property empire. And you have a section in your book with Mr. Xu Jiayin, who's the founder of that company. I think when you went to France on a wine tasting tour and inspecting yachts and the like, and I thought that was a pretty telling scene as well. So when you look at something like Evergrande now, do you see that empire unraveling? Because if it does, it's going to have a big impact.
I think, well, I mean, unraveling, I think there are different perspectives on this way to look at it. I think, first of all, I think this company is going to be taken over by the state. That I think that's almost a given. I think the fate of Xu Jiayin not going to be, and the ending would not be well. I'm sure, you know, I think his personal wealth will be mostly gone. And then whether he goes to prison or not, is also not out of the question. In terms of how much a negative impact in the overall situation, that I think it depends on how the state deal with it. And the question is basically, I would guess they will probably, to a certain extent, take care of the foreign investors, and then the domestic investor will probably suffer the most. But I think given, you know, this at this stage, as you mentioned just earlier, I agree with you. I don't think that's going to kill the party or really kill the China story in a large way.
Just a final question. It's, there's quite remarkable revelations in this book, and China is an opaque system and very sensitive about such revelations. Do you feel safe having written and published this book?
I think, sensitive is a very minor way to talk about it. I think that as always, the Communist Party, they want to dominate the storyline. They want the only one telling the story about China. Anybody deviates from their storyline, they don't want to kill that voice. That's the reality. In my situation, I was just reflecting. I mean, I just on my way back, and then thinking in our discussion and thinking about my book. And I think a lot of coincidence happened all my life sort of pushed me to this stage to publish the book, because it is the personal cost is tremendous. I to be frank, I mean, two things I have to say. I mean, one is, you know, a week ago, I refreshed my will, you know, knowing anything and everything can possibly happen. And I don't want my will be in the way if something happened to me. And then second thing I want to say is, you know, a party system then put a woman in a dark cell for 4 years is capable of all evils.
Yes, well, on that not so uplifting note, thank you very much, Desmond Shin, for speaking to us today and for being so frank. The name of the book, again, is Red Roulette, an insider's account of wealth, power, corruption, and vengeance in today's China. My name is Richard McGregor, and thanks to Josh Godding for his help in today's production for Lowy Institute Conversations. Thank you very much.